let's start with this.
I'll borrow something from tomorrow's title. Has anybody ever heard of this one? I'll make it easier. Has anybody ever been bothered by the question why bad things happen to good people? Have you ever heard of this? Has this occurred to you? Is there anybody here who's not bothered by this, does not care? Okay. Does that mean that everyone else does care? Yes? Now, before I trap you, I'm being honest. Let me ask you this. There's two ways you could be bothered by it. You could be bothered by it on an intellectual level. You could be bothered by it on an emotional level. Do you feel that you're bothered? Does anybody feel they're not bothered on an intellectual level? This is not an intellectual problem, purely emotional? Both is also okay, but I'm saying, does anybody feel that this is not an intellectual issue whatsoever? Okay, anyone else? Yeah? It's purely emotional.
It was intellectual, but now it's
like... because it's solved for you, because you thought about it. Okay.
Purely intellectual.
Okay. If anybody thinks that there is an intellectual question if anyone thinks that this is an intellectual question, then we'll be able to proceed. And I'll just try to share with you what concerns me. See, there is a phenomenon which I would call a good question, and there's a phenomenon which I would call a bad question. Do you appreciate the difference between the two or not necessarily? Should I give you an example between a good question and a bad question? Without pointing fingers at anybody here? Okay. A good, bad question. It's 10:20 in the morning. Why is it light outside? Is that a good question? Does anybody think that's a really good question? No. Your question is 10:20 in the morning. Why am I up? That's a different question. It's 10:20 in the morning. Why is it light outside? Or I look at my watch. It's 10:20. Why is it light? Is not a very good question. The answer is because it's 10:20 in the morning, you idiot. Get out of bed. What are you talking about? Excuse me?
Because if it's wide light, why the sun's up, how the sun works, how light comes down from the sun,
It's 10:20 in the morning, why is it light? Is not a very good question.
It depends on what level you're
on. Not on the level he's asking. Seriously, that's not a good question, because the answer to the question is going to be because it's light outside, because it's the morning. Let me just give you an example of a bad question. But you're right. I keep forgetting. Excuse me? Here's a good question. In the early spring, my 3-year-old is told to go to bed. It's his bedtime at 7:00 in the evening. And he says to me, how can it be my bedtime? It's still light outside. Is that a good question? Because as far as his memory goes, he goes to sleep when it's dark. Springtime comes, days get a little longer, they change the clock, and I tell him it's 7:00. The kid can't tell time. He barely trusts me. I tell him it's his bedtime. He thinks that he's just been bothering me. I want to get him away. Saying, well, looks like it's bedtime. Go to sleep. He goes, well, what are you talking about? It's the light outside. Now, that's a very good question. I have to explain to him that the days get longer, which is outside of the experience of the 3-year-old, although that the sun comes up every morning is, I think, within the experience of most people, and therefore the question why, at least on the level I was asking on, if you guys were right, there are always other levels you can take it. But the question, why is it light in the morning, is not a very good question, because it's morning would really be the answer. If you thought it was 10:00 at night and you got confused, that's something else, but 10:00 in the morning, it's supposed to be light. So that would be my examples of both a good question and a bad question. I would say that the main difference between the two is that one has a good premise to it and the other one has no premise to it. The good question has a very good premise, because something does not make sense, something does not add up properly, while the bad question was that it wasn't that there was a very good premise, it was a bad premise, you just didn't understand what you were talking about. I would prefer that the topic that we deal with today end up being a good question, because I think it's terribly disappointing if you just decide, well, this thing which has been tormenting humanity for the last number of millennia is actually a very bad question. I think it's a good question. I think most people here suspect it's a good question. But if why bad things happen to good people is a good question, I think there is a premise. And let's start with the premise. The person who says why do bad things happen to good people is assuming that bad things should not happen to good people. Is that correct? Yes? Now, why shouldn't bad things happen to good people? Which means that they're assuming, therefore, that there is justice in the world. It means that they're assuming. The question itself is presuming there's justice. Because if there isn't justice, then why? Then what's the question? Which means there's, when it comes down to it, there's two simple possibilities. One is that everything is random, and one thing is that aren't random. If everything is random, so then the question is an absurdity. I mean, does cancer is a terrible disease? I mean, does it really know the difference if you've been spending your money or somebody else's money? I mean, the whole question is an absolute absurdity, which means, from a logical perspective, if you believe everything's random, which means the person who asks why do bad things happen to good people is assuming bad things shouldn't happen to good people, which means that there is assuming that there's justice in the world, which means that they're assuming, this is a little difficult, that there's a judge, which means, call it by any other name, that they believe in God. Was that terrible, what I just now did?
Well, you don't have to go that far.
See that? I knew there would be somebody. Yes, you do. But you know what? If you don't want to call it God, I don't care. Call him Ralph. Call it karma. Call it whatever you want to call it. You can't. Yeah, call it whatever you want. You cannot avoid this. You really can't. And I'll fight you if you want. You can't. It's an absurdity. The person who asks the question, why do bad things happen to good people, is assuming that it shouldn't happen, which means assuming that they believe there's justice, they believe that there's a judge, it means that they believe that there's a God, even though many people that are bothered by this are not willing to work this all the way through, so it's not my fault that people want to be shallow. I'm sorry if I'm insulting half of you. Not so sorry.
There has to be preemptive as in God before you can ask the question.
Let me continue, because I don't care if there's a God or not, so you don't get it yet. I don't care. What I'm saying is that if people are bothered by this question, they believe in God. So don't bother me if God exists or God doesn't exist. That's not the issue. If someone's going to ask this question and thinks that it's a good question, that means that they're assuming that God exists. Whether God exists or not is not the issue right now. Therefore, the individual... By the way, anybody know how you ask this question, what this is called in philosophy?
Theodicy.
And what does theodicy mean? What does it mean? What does theodicy mean? Anyone? Judging God. That's what the words mean. Theo, right? In terms of that, theodicy means judging God, which means that in terms of philosophy, there's no confusion about this. Asking why bad things happen to good people is theodicy. It's judging God, which really means that there's another issue that we have to consider. In order for this question to begin, you need to believe that God exists. A bunch of atheists cannot get together and ask the intellectual question, why do bad things happen to good people? Do you all accept that? They're wasting their time then if they do. If they want to say that emotionally I'm tormented by this, that's a different issue. Again, that's why I'm making a distinction between an intellectual question versus an emotional question. If a bunch of atheists get together and say, you know, there's this really deep theological problem we're dealing with, why do bad things happen to good people? That's an absurdity. By the way, they may not really be atheists. But I don't want to be the one to tell them this. I don't want to ruin their day and say, listen, Mr. Atheist, I got some bad news for you. I once gave a lecture in South Africa, and they said, okay, you have 20 minutes, go ahead. To each class, right? 20 minutes. I went with Dr. Schroeder and with Tom Meyer. It was like traveling to cartoon characters. I was with Tom and Jerry, but anyway. I have 20 minutes, so I say, okay, who believes in God? So almost all the hands go up. Three hands don't go up. So I ask them, you believe in God? Two of them say, we're not sure. And then there's a girl there says, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist. Okay, I ask a couple more questions. I say, how many of you keep kosher? More than half keep kosher. By the way, 90% believe in God, more than half keep kosher. And including the people keeping kosher is the atheist, which of course got my interest. And I said, she said, I don't want to cause fights with my parents, and they keep kosher, whatever, so I keep kosher, respect, and so on. Okay, very nice. And then I asked, how many people here have ever experienced God? By the way, at this point, I looked at my watch, I had 12 minutes, and I'm out of there, so I can ask anything. So I said, how many of you ever experienced God? And one hand goes up. Go ahead. Guess which one? The atheist, yeah. Because a couple minutes ago, you know, you're an atheist. And it turned out that she said she was once standing by the coattail. She felt this incredible connection with divinity and so on and so forth. But her her claim to be an atheist was because her grandmother was very, very sick and dying, and she had a very difficult time relating to God while this was happening, so she decided she was an atheist. But that's fascinating, because what she's saying is that she has a problem of why bad things happen to good people, and therefore she has concluded, therefore, that God doesn't exist. Although her conclusion is not a very sophisticated conclusion, because she herself will tell you that she's experienced God. I'm not going to question whether that's true or not, but that's her experience. So she's willing to live with those contradictions. That's amazing. So here it was a wonderful example where somebody claims to be an atheist, but was not willing to really follow that all the way through. On an emotional level, yes. An atheist can ask, an atheist convention can get together and say, how are we to deal with the emotional problem that people suffer in this world? That is a very legitimate question. On the other hand, the intellectual question to say, why do bad things happen to good people, if you're an atheist, is an absolute absurdity, because it's a stupid question. It's asking at 10 o'clock in the morning, why is it light outside? If you're an atheist, then everything's random. If everything's random, bad things will happen to bad people, and bad things happen to good people. Why would you even assume that something else should happen? Why should you? There is nothing there, which means, if there is somebody in this room, again, that's what I'm saying, I don't care, you believe in God, you don't believe in God. I mean, this is your problem. If you are bothered by this question, why bad things happen to good people, I have very bad news for you. It means you believe in God. If you're not bothered by the question anymore, you've thought about it, you come to the conclusion, you know what? There must not be a God, fine. But that's only assuming you're not bothered by the question. If you're bothered by the question still, it means you don't believe. That means that you believe in God. Doesn't mean that you like God. Doesn't mean you have a wonderful relationship with God. Doesn't mean you're on talking terms with God. But it means that you believe in God, else there's no question. Sir, you've been patient.
Yeah. More simply, in philosophy, you have the problem of evil, which is there's this evil, so that's...
Don't you like the way I turned that around? I know the problem in philosophy.
Yeah.
I know. I turned it around. You saw that?
I thought you turned it around.
Yeah. Isn't that good?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You seem to be assuming this, like there has to be, like if bad things happen to good people, then there has to be God.
I'm assuming the person who poses the question believes in God. That's his premise.
Rabbi, could there just be... What's that?
Whether God exists, no. Whether God exists or not, no. There can't be natural law. One second. Which one do you want me to answer first here? Whether the person believes in God or whether God exists is not the issue right now. If a person says, why do bad things happen to good people? What's he asking? You explain it to me. Is there justice? Fine. So why should there be justice? And if you say to them, what do you mean by justice? Do you mean, why don't we catch all the robbers? Or are you talking about illness and things like that? What will they say? Illness. So then you, again, maybe I did this too quickly. Then you question it further. Well, why do you think that illness should only happen to bad people? Why do you think that all the fascists and all the heads of the mafia should drop dead and all the people who give charity should live longer? Because you must believe there's something overseeing the world, and that's just not nature. So I don't know what you're talking about.
The natural laws that are creating the world, we don't know about the God part, but we know that the world was constructed in a certain way and that it follows a sort of pattern.
What kind of pattern? What are you talking about?
The balance of the universe.
What balance? I don't know what you're talking. Say it. Call it God. What's the problem? You're afraid that you're going to find a starved David on your chest or something after this? No, I'm really questioning. Why in the world will somebody want to say, I believe in natural law? What does that mean, natural law? That is not one of the rules of nature. Why are you asking me to take a leap of faith and to believe in nature? Is this, one second, is what I'm saying today so shocking? Sir.
So if you have a conditional statement, I would think an atheist can make a conditional statement, saying if there's a God, then there would be justice in the world.
No. That's what he tried to do to me also. An atheist can say whatever he wants. I told you, I don't care about atheists. What I care about is that there are a lot of people in the world who are bothered by this question. I'm just suggesting that to be bothered by this question means you have to believe in God, otherwise there's no question. That's all. I don't care about I told you, the atheist can just be amused and listen to a rabbi talk all sorts of silly things today. Okay? If you're an atheist, just sit back and listen, have a good time. Go back to the atheist convention afterwards and say, you should hear what this guy's saying. But my question is very, very specific. My statement is very specific. If an individual is bothered by this question, it means he believes in God whether he knows about it or not. An atheist cannot be bothered by this question.
I think he could ascribe certain qualities to what he thinks. Subjective qualities.
An atheist cannot be bothered by this question. I'm sorry I'm being so difficult with you today. You want me to back up and say, okay, I give in? I just don't know what you're talking about. How can you explain it to me?
I'm saying, like, to be bothered by the question, it can be a conditional statement.
Why are you bothered by the question? Okay, you play the atheist, I'll play the religious fanatic. Go ahead.
Okay.
I've had a lot of practice with this.
Okay. So, I think if there's a God in the world, that there should be justice, that people shouldn't...
That's not the question that we started with. That wasn't the question. The question is, why are you bothered? Are you bothered that bad things happen to good people? That was the question I started with.
Okay, well, we're on a different way.
No, so go back to my question. An atheist...
I misunderstood the initial question.
Okay, so if an atheist... I'll say it again then. If an atheist says, look at all the bad that happens in the world, therefore I don't believe in God, I said I'm fine with that. It's when the atheist turns it around and says that I'm really bothered by this question, why do bad things happen to good people? That latter person, I'm suggesting, may not really be an atheist.
I think maybe the question that you were sort of basically searching for would be, let's say, a mafia boss who's constantly...
Be careful, you don't know who's in the room, by the way. Go ahead.
who's constantly in line with bullets and what have you, knives and whatnot, gets away with it the whole time, whereas an innocent man who walks on the street who's very good can just get shot in the head just like that.
Right.
What he's saying is that's just random chance.
Right. So if you're not...
That's unfortunate, but even though this is the question an atheist could ask, because it's an interesting thought that even though the mafia man is so much closer to all this danger and he gets away with it, yet the innocent man who's never close to it at all doesn't.
Can I be an atheist rabbi then, just to respond?
Just for a minute.
Grow up. Grow up. The world is random. There's no God. Forget about it.
That's the point we're trying.
But if you... that's what I'm insisting. The individual who's bothered by this, his premise is that there's justice in the world, so that means he believes in God. Till he comes to the point that he's satisfied that there's no justice. I'm fine with you on that. Yeah.
I just think it's a bit simplistic to say that good things should always have to good people, bad things should always have to bad people.
I agree. Correct.
It just doesn't make sense.
Correct. That we'll get more to maybe tomorrow. Your point is correct. Yes.
You're assuming that there is a just God, but...
Okay, that's what I'm going to get to right now. That's the next point. Yes.
The person who asks that assumes also that this is the only life and the only world we have. Our justice calculations should be based on...
I'm not even... Again, the last three points, I'm not even up to that yet. What I was making is one very simple point. The avowed atheist who's bothered by this question really is in for an existential crisis when he begins to think about it. That was my point. If he, at the end of the day, says, I was really being silly, and there is no justice in the world, fine. My point is that the question, as every question, has a premise, and I don't like people being really stupid asking stupid questions. I prefer the question to be a little bit more sophisticated. And again, I am completely allowing for the possibility that the atheists that get together and talk about this and are bothered by this are not bothered on an intellectual level, are bothered on an emotional level. How can we deal with this problem? Let me move on a little bit. As some of you started to point out now, in order for this question to begin, you have to believe that there's a God. In order for the question to be sustained, you have to believe certain things about God. You have to believe that God is completely good, completely powerful, and completely knowledgeable. If you take away any one of those three definitions about God, you again will have solved the problem immediately. What you would have done is, your premise would have been that God exists. Your conclusion would have been that God is not what he claims to be, or what I thought he was, that God can't live up to his press clippings, and God is really not all that good. Work it through. If I were to say that God is completely good and completely powerful and not completely knowledgeable, why do bad things happen? Because he doesn't know about it. If I say God is completely good and completely knowledgeable and not completely powerful, why do bad things happen? Because he can't do anything about it. If I say God is completely powerful, completely knowledgeable, not completely good, why do bad things happen? Because God is not completely good. The challenge for me, as a spokesperson, as an underpaid spokesperson for the Jewish people, is to try to take these three definitions, to retain these definitions, and to say, how could it be that God is, in my mind, completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable, and still bad things happen? That's my challenge over here. As I said, there's two different extremes. The atheist cannot have this question and still retain to be an atheist. On the other hand, the rabbi or the theologian is going to have to try to explain how can he retain his belief, right? because he has to retain that God is these three things. What you'll find is virtually every single religion or philosophy who's dealt with this question have simply taken away one of these definitions, at least one of these definitions of God. For example, is anyone aware of anyone who took away God being all-knowledgeable? Start with that. It's big in the 18th century, which is very interesting in terms of...
The deists.
Right, the deists. Why? Why do they do that?
Because it's convenient.
Well, see, this is interesting. If any of you studied intellectual history, you'll know that when the various revolutions took place in the 18th century, the main objective was to take away the power from the monarchs and the power of the church and create a new social order. And therefore, the monarchs were relatively easy. Some countries, you executed them. Others, you simply put them in their place. The church, they did the same thing. Some they got rid of them, and some they put them in their place. The intellectual justification for that was really what the deists were creating. They were saying, we believe that God created the world, but we think that God is on an extended vacation. God is no longer involved. God's retired in Miami Beach, Florida now, playing shuffleboard, doesn't have the beep or the cell phone, doesn't know what's going on anymore. God is out of the loop, God's out of touch. But by the way, if you think about this, if God could be in control but chooses not to be in control, or God could be aware but chooses not to be aware, that means that God is not so good either. And if God is not aware, God is not fully powerful either. Which means that means what they're saying is that God is theoretically completely good, powerful, and knowledgeable, but the reality is God is none of the above. Which is why deists don't really exist today. Most deists have already long ago become either agnostics or atheists. Because why play this game of saying, yes, I believe God created the world? It was a social climate at that point that people found it very difficult to move from adherence, mainly to Christian belief, to complete atheism. So they did is they took a middle step. The middle step was deism. God created the world but abandoned it. Again, my point is that the God who created the world and abandoned it is neither good nor powerful nor knowledgeable, or is emasculated to the extent that he's no longer God, and therefore you've solved the problem, but therefore why do bad things happen? The world's completely random again. And what you've ended up doing is you're back to the beginning, that you really don't have a question because God is not God. Sir?
I was just about to ask the question before you said it. What would actually happen if God left the world? Because he is infinite, from the point of view of a rabbi. He's infinite, and
yes,
he has the ability to leave. So I'll tell you something.
To answer this properly, it would take me a lot of time. So I'm going to say it properly, but very quickly. And if anyone has any clue what I'm talking about, then good. If not, then what can I do? Then maybe I can confuse you. From a Jewish mystical perspective, the problem is a little different, because if God is infinite, then it's very difficult to even imagine creation, because how can you add something finite to something which is infinite? Because mathematically, that's impossibility, because infinite plus finite remains infinite. So therefore, the sum total of the entire universe is infinity. So therefore, this thing which we call the universe, we call life, is something which is finite, subsumed within the infinite. But since you can't add something to infinite, the mystics describes creation by taking place by something which they called tzimtzum, as self-contraction. So therefore, in order for the world to be created, God is holding back infinity and allowing a finite coexistence. So therefore, the whole idea of creation is God holding back. If God were to let go, it's not the God that would disappear, it's the world that would disappear. So therefore, this whole philosophical possibility of God creating the world and abandoning it is an impossibility based upon the mystical perspective, because what would happen if God would ever to abandon the world, the universe would cease to exist and not God.
So you just explained to me that God can't possibly be infinite.
If you like. I didn't, but that's what you understood.
Well, you said he's holding back.
Yeah.
He's holding back from his infinite.
No, God creates a possibility that you existing in the finite can have an egocentric perspective instead of a theocentric perspective, which doesn't necessarily impinge on God's infinity. It impinges on your ability to understand God's infinity. Okay, so then we're on the same wavelength. No, that is most likely true anyway. What? That's most likely true anyway, because coming from our perspective, we'll have a great difficulty with it. But what I said now, I think, is extremely important, because we tend always to look at the world from the egocentric perspective, and it's just not a true perspective. But then realize that the mystical understanding is the whole creation is based on God holding back. God lets go of the world as God, not God.
Wouldn't a polytheistic view of this have better arguments than that there's a God of goodness and a God of evil, and yet they're fighting?
Dualistic? So I'll get back to that one second. No. But maybe. let me get to that. Is there any religion, very famous religion, that's a hint, that believes that God is not completely powerful? I'm upset. Yeah, Christianity. Is anybody? I hope no one gets upset with me. If any closet Christians come, don't crucify me or anything for this. But just listen a second. If you were to ask a Christian, I've done this. And you could try it also. Next time, like you meet one of these guys on the streets, go out and say, and ask, where does evil come from? So what's the answer? Lucifer. What? Why is there evil in the world? So, why is there evil in the world? Because of the devil. Who's in charge of evil? Devil. Could God stop the devil? You're being logical now. I said, ask a Christian. Can you put your Christian hat on right now? If you were to ask a Christian, no, right. You were just thinking there. That's a problem. Stop thinking. I don't know. If you want, we can give you a lobotomy for the class. Although the great words of Arlo Guthrie, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. Words to think of that. So listen. Classical, he's going to write that down now, right? That was the best thing I heard since I've been in Israel. The classic Christian way of dealing with this problem of why there's evil in the world, because again, God is completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable, and why do bad things happen? So, surprisingly, Christianity was willing to say that evil takes place because of the devil. The devil causes bad things to happen. The devil is a fallen angel. The devil has achieved a level of independence. And therefore, there's evil in the world. Now, does anybody realize the slight theological difficulty with that? What is it? Not just God not being infinite. They don't believe in monotheism. It's very difficult, by the way. It comes as a shock to most Christians to find out that they're dualists. Yes. I've had a perverse pleasure of pointing this out. The Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. I'll concede to them every time because they don't know what they're talking about. No, I'm being serious. I've always conceded that to them. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Fine. Although I did have difficulty. I was discussing this with an individual around a half a year ago, and I asked him. See, I try to do what you do. Just try to be logical. I said, okay. You have this Trinity, you have the Father and the Son because of original sin. Did Adam have free choice? Yes. He told me yes. What if Adam would not have sinned? Does that mean Jesus never would have lived? And he couldn't deal with this question. No, he just didn't know what to do with it. This guy was a minister. He was a minister for Jews for Jesus in California. He just had no idea what to do with this question. Because the existence of Jesus is something which is so basic for them to say, well, maybe you can just have existence without it. He just, again, did not begin to know what to do. But let's leave that for a second. I'll concede the Trinity issue, because if you begin to question it a little bit more, you'll get to this point, well, that's mystery, we really don't know how that works. Like if I also asked him, this is an old question, if Jesus is on the cross, and Jesus is God, and Jesus says, my Lord, why have you forsaken me, who's he talking to? And does he want to be saved? Does he not want to be saved? Did he forsake himself or not? Meaning, if he really wants to be saved, that means he's not in on the plan. I'm having fun now. So if...
Rabbi,
just one second. If, yeah? Who's he talking to?
No, I was going to say, couldn't, in Christian theology, couldn't they say that God has allowed Satan, so to speak, to...
Yes, they could. They could, but what's fascinating is they don't say that. Theoretically, they could. And what's interesting, in a lot of post-Holocaust Christian theology, you do get to that point. In the first 19 or so centuries, they don't make that point. They'd rather say, no, there is the devil and there is God. See, you know what's so interesting about this? In Judaism, we also believe there's a struggle. Mm-hmm. What's the struggle between? Man has the struggle between his evil inclination and his good inclination. Every single one of us has a struggle going on. In Christianity, the struggle does not go on within man. Man, forget about it. Man cannot succeed. Man's a loser. Man is tainted by sin, and the only thing that man can do is put his faith in God. The struggle, according to Christianity, is between God and the devil.
You
take out responsibility.
And then there's no responsibility. Exactly, exactly. And then you take out the responsibility. You say, man, you're a loser, you can't do anything. God is involved in this epic battle, this cosmic battle between good and evil, and let's hope that God wins. Okay, no, so you start to think about it. So first of all, you know what the best answer I ever heard from a priest on this point was could God stop the devil? The answer was, he's working on it. I'm not making fun of that. See, that's very elegant. Because what he's saying is that God is involved in the struggle, and that's why Jesus could even be tempted on the cross. Because God, as far as they're concerned, is involved in this struggle. Man, just forget about it. You know what? Judaism takes man a lot more seriously. Judaism says to people, you have freedom of choice. You have the ability to make decisions. You have greatness to you. And Christianity says, forget about it. You're just completely tainted by the sin and you can't do anything. So therefore, while we believe in one all-powerful God, we believe that we have within us a capability or a capacity to choose between good and evil. As far as Christianity goes, this is what's so amazing and what's really so powerful about this issue. They were so bothered by this possibility or this problem of evil, this issue of theodicy, how could bad things happen to good people, they were willing to sacrifice monotheism. Do you realize this? They're willing to sacrifice monotheism in order to be able to push the question away. So then what happens at the end of the day? God is still completely good. God is completely knowledgeable. He's always there for you. He's just not quite as powerful as you thought. So put all you can pray to God because he's always there listening. He's completely good. He wants the best for you. But God just can't, you know, really do everything. But he's working on it. And one day the kingdom of God will be established. It's Sunday. Okay. And one day the kingdom of God will be established on this earth. And put your faith and everything will work out. Okay. Very nice. By the way, did anybody here ever read the book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People by Rabbi Kushner? Do you remember what his solution was to the problem?
I've read it a long time ago.
Do you think you use God to help you get through it?
Well, what he says is like this. Why do bad things happen? He's a conservative rabbi.
When
bad things happen to good people. He wrote a best-selling book. Got to hand it to him. New York Times bestseller list. Right? He had a son who died of a terrible disease. This disease where people age rapidly. Lots of pain, short life, and death. And he said that he had a very difficult time praying to God, relating to God after this happened, which is something I think we can all understand. And he finally came to a conclusion that his son was not killed by God. It wasn't God who killed him. It was nature. Right? It was nature can do, back to your natural law, nature can do all sorts of things, and nature killed his son. So now he's able to go back and has his relationship with God again. God is still completely good and completely kind, and you can pray to God and have wonderful relationship with God. But again, what's the purpose? Why do you want to pray to God who can't even control nature? But do you realize what he really did? He took the Christian understanding and he updated it. He made a kinder, gentler devil. Think about it. It's a 20th century Christian perspective where nature has replaced the devil. God is now completely good and completely knowledgeable, just not completely powerful. This terrible thing that God can't control is now called nature. And that's why it was a best-selling book among Christians. A lot of them get like real hung up with this whole devil thing. Okay, you don't have to deal with the devil. It's not the devil. Instead, we can call it nature. Now, in the next 8 minutes, I want to try to deal with the Jewish perspective of this problem. As I said, tomorrow I'm going to continue. We'll see how far we can get today. There is a verse in the Torah which many people who pray almost say it every day. Okay, in the beginning of the blessings for Kriyat Shema. Excuse me? Yes, right. Exactly. So in the Siddur, when we read this, we say, Blessed is God, King of the world, who is Yotzer Or, that means forms light, Vore Choshech, creates darkness, Oseh Shalom, makes peace, and how does the phrase end? Uvore es hakol. That's what it says in the Siddur. Which means, and God creates everything. Now, if you already said God makes light, God forms light, creates darkness, makes peace, and creates everything, what's this everything which is left over that we sort of don't want to say every single day? So those of you want to know, if you open up your Siddur and you look over here in your art scroll Siddur, you have footnote number 5, which tells you, go look to Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. Then you open up your Bible to Isaiah 45:7, and you find that it doesn't say exactly what we say in the Siddur every day. I'll go one or two verses earlier. I am God, there is no other. The Hebrew. I don't like the English. Ani Hashem ve'en od. I am God, there is no other. Zulati, aside from me, ein elokim, there is no power. You should know from the setting of the sun and so on, there is none aside from me. I am God, there is no other. And now he continues, I, Yotzer Or, form light, Vore Choshech, create darkness, Ose Shalom, makes peace, Uvore Ra, and creates evil. Ani Hashem Ose Kol Eila, I am God who does all these things. By the way, this is very interesting. Judaism says, based on Isaiah, that God causes evil in the world. Do you realize, this may sound a little trite, but you don't know how many Jews have been killed because of this. When we turn around to the Christians and say, and the Christians say, where did evil come from? And we say, well, God causes evil. Do you know what they say? No, because where do they think evil comes from? The devil. So therefore they say the God that you worship creates evil. You're devil worshippers. This is where it comes from. Because we claim that everything comes from God because we really do believe in monotheism. They have sort of ignored monotheism, sold off in monotheism, so therefore bad comes from the devil. We say, no, the God we worship does good and bad. They say, you're devil worshippers.
Don't many of the proofs they use come from Isaiah also?
Of course. Two chapters later, they'll try to prove to you the virgin birth. That won't stop them. Your question is correct. Why don't they seem to know about this verse?
Well, they obviously seem to know about
it. You know, the best thing that they normally do is just translate things a little differently. But forget about Christianity now. I want to understand this in a much deeper way right now. There were a couple of words that were used over here that need to be analyzed. One was form and the other was create. What's the difference between formation versus creation?
Forming is starting something off and letting it grow. Whereas creating is making something and sustaining it.
Can be a little more precise.
Creating evil.
Right. Who said it? Go ahead.
I can't just like translate this.
Say it in Latin. I was okay with it. That's how you got my attention with ex nihilo.
Right.
Something from nothing. The difference. Okay, I'll do it for you. I've done this before.
From
void. Ex nihilo, from nothingness,
right.
Which means creation means creating something from nothing. That's creation, to create something. That's what I said a little bit more precise than you were saying it. To form something is to form something from something which already exists. Right? Did I create the desk from the wood, or did I form the desk from the wood? Which one?
Form.
Ultimately, who's the only being that can create? God. In the beginning, God creates. Bereshit bara Elokim. God creates. We form. God creates. What's interesting now is this verse. God says, I am God, there is no other, I do all these things. What? Yotzer or uvore choshech. So God says, I form light, but create darkness. I make peace and create evil. So why is the different forms being used? Where does lightness come? Where does light come from? Light is formed. When it's talking here about light, what does it mean? God says, I make light, but I create darkness. So at the moment of creation, we're told that there's some type of primordial light, and this primordial light comes into the world, but that's formed. But at the point of creation, darkness comes into the world. By the way, this goes back to what I said earlier that none of you understood about the Tzimtzum, about God's self-contraction. That at the moment of creation, this world has all types of light, all sorts of good coming from God, but something new is created that never existed before. Doesn't exist within God. What's that? Darkness. God says, I make peace, but I create evil. What does that tell you? If God creates evil, that means that evil does not exist within God, else evil would be formed and not created. Let me try to explain this based upon a passage of the Zohar that maybe you'll enjoy. The Zohar creates the following example or metaphor. Let's say you have a king, and the king loves his child deeply. And because of his great love for his child, he educates him, he raises him, teaches him, inspires him. But at some point, he realizes that life within the palace is limited, and he tells his son, I want you now to live outside of the palace for a while. At some point you'll come back, we'll be reunited. But I want you to go back and live your life based upon what I've taught you in the palace. Till now, did that make any sense? Okay, who's the king? see how well versed you are in Zohar. King is God. Who is the sun? Us. What's the palace?
The world.
Which world?
The real world.
The real world, correct, which is? Right. Heaven. Heaven. Which means God exists, God is the king, live in the palace, most wonderful place. In this palace of God, your soul connects to God, the most wonderful relationship, everything is great. Your soul gets inspired, and again, all is wonderful, except for one thing. You don't have any independence, you have no choice. Living in the palace of the king, you're extremely limited in what you can do, and the king is always there. You can't find yourself in the king's palace. So therefore, to solve this problem, the king says to the son, I'm going to now send you out of the palace because I want you to experience the real world, and one day you'll come back. When will you come back? When you die, right? Off in the future. Now, what's more comfortable, life in the palace or life outside?
In the palace.
In the palace, absolutely. Now you understand why the Talmud can say that Noach lo la'adim shela nivra. It would have been more comfortable for man had he never been created. Living in the palace is wonderful. Leaving the palace is something which has difficulty to it, but it has meaning, which is probably the major issue. It has meaning. So the king says to the son, leave the palace. The king leaves the palace. But this, again, is the same process of Tzimtzum that I said before. The fact that we could have lived in God's palace and God then, because of his love, holds back and says, now leave the palace. Let me try to explain this a little bit more, and I'm sorry if I'm going to go over time. Apologize. Every parent has to go through the same process. Would your life be better if your parents were with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Do you realize where your parents may have a desire to do that in order to protect you, to keep you away from all sorts of dangers and all sorts of problems in this world? The parent wants to protect the child. That's what a parent really wants. Parents want the best for the child, want the child to be happy. The parent wants to protect the child. On the other hand, if you overprotect the child, you destroy the child. You have to be able to practice tzimtzum on an individual basis, pull back, and give the child room to live. So this process is not easy. And you're right. Our lives would not be better if your parents... I mean, anybody not clear about that? You go on a date, your mother's in the back seat of the car. Go to a pub, your father's like pouring the drinks. I mean... Hey, son, how's it going? Good luck. I mean... In the dormitory, your father's your roommate. I mean, life will be very short. Yeah. Okay, anyway. Would our lives be better if God were with us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Be careful. Would it be better?
Yeah.
Would it be better if God were with us all the time? You want to have that cheeseburger, you pick it up in your hand, and God is there, 1 second, and God is there, taps on your shoulder, said, I wouldn't do that if I were you? And I'm not talking about cholesterol. Eternal damnation. So one second. I know. 1 second. Would that be better? Do you think you should get great reward for not eating the cheeseburger? God's looking at you, pointing his finger and says, eternal damnation if that goes into your mouth. So what do you do? God, quick, go over there, make an earthquake. No, leave me alone. I mean... So listen. The reality is that God is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but he allows you to have this wonderful fantasy and make believe he's not watching. So during your fantasy, you can do all sorts of things you want, but God is right there all the time. But the symptom, this goes back to your question before, the symptom, God's contraction, is what gives you the ability of having this fantasy and making believe that he's not there. So, kid leaves the palace. Truth is, the king is watching every move that he takes. Right? As the song goes, every breath he takes, right? I'll be watching. The king is there, he's watching every single thing. Next scene, king calls in this woman. Beautiful woman. Sorry. Exquisitely beautiful woman. And he says to her, I want you to dress up in a very seductive manner, and I want you to go out and try to seduce my son. Now think a second before you answer this. What does the king want?
The son to say no.
He wants the son to say no. But all this couldn't take place in the palace because the king's right there in the palace. So the king backs up and says to the kid, go ahead, lead your life, follow the things that I taught you. Create the situation. Who is this? As old as Zohar. Who is this woman? She's the devil. She is a servant of the king. In Judaism, the devil is not somebody who's rebelled against God. It's a servant of the king. What does she want to happen? Does she want to be accepted or rejected? She wants to be rejected when it comes down to it, because she's a servant of the king. But she knows the better show she puts on, the better it is for the kid to reject her. So the kid goes off into a bar that night, and this woman sort of... I don't know, sort of walks into the room. That's not the right word, but catches his eye from the other side, and he's having difficulty breathing, and he's experiencing something that he never experienced before while in the palace. But it's really interesting, because the king knows what's going on. He's completely powerful. He's completely good, because he created the situation, because he wants the kid to be independent. He's completely good. He's completely powerful. He's completely knowledgeable, because he knows what's going on. He's powerful. He's, which means, just on a theological level, I've already been able to set up the Jewish model and to put it into the real world. At some point in the morning, the sun can come through, hit her, the ray of sun hits her in the face in the morning, and suddenly he looks at her and he realizes he's not who he thought she was. Now he realizes that she's really one of the servants of the king dressed up, which, by the way, is a wonderful moment of recognition for every sinner to realize that the sin that he's so much lusted after and so embraced the night before, now he realizes it was really a servant of God dressed up in a very seductive manner, pulling us away, but what that really was a servant of God that we were meant to reject. Which means what the Zohar has, in my mind at least, succeeded in doing is at least created the model and said that God can be completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable. Things can happen in this world which we are there to reject. If we don't reject it, that was our choice through our free choice. If we did succeed in rejecting it, then we have elevated ourselves and become all that much closer by the king. We can't do that in the palace, and that's what this world is all about. And that's why the verse says that all the good that exists in this earth, all the good is something which comes from the primordial good that comes from God. That good is formed. Light is formed. Darkness is created. There is no darkness in the palace. That's something completely new. That is the result of the tzimtzum, the result of God holding back. God is not here. God you can't see right now. That evil is something which is created. This is what the Christian theologians did not understand and did not want to understand. They'd rather have it as a battle between good and evil. Pick God. Avoid evil, your problem with that is dualism. Judaism preferred to say, no, everything comes from God. And straight, it's Isaiah. Everything comes from God. Good and evil, but there's a difference. Good is formed. Good is directly connected to God. Evil is something external to God, something which is only created when God practices the tzimtzum and pulls back. So yesterday we began to discuss the problem of theodicy, of why bad things happen to good people. And what I attempted to show, although there was much resistance, and it was very exciting here. Raymond, you missed it. You've been screaming at me yesterday also. And I probably would have insulted you like, okay, anyway. Correct?
Yes.
Absolutely, right? My observation is that many people that I've come in contact with over my years involved in education and even before that. Can you hear me in the back? Is this working? Is something going on? You going? Okay. Is that many people are bothered by this question of why bad things happen to good people. So my observation was that if someone's bothered by the question of why bad things happen to good people, they're assuming that bad things shouldn't happen to good people. Is that like a major revelation for anybody? No? Or is that correct? Only you people that weren't here yesterday. Is that correct or is that incorrect? If you ask the question why bad things happen to good people, it means you assume that bad things should not happen to good people. Right. Right. So why not? Why shouldn't bad things happen to good people? It means that whoever thinks that bad things shouldn't happen to good people, the premise that they're working with is that there is some sort of justice in the world, which means that there's some sort of judge in the world, which means, call it by any other name, that they believe in God. Now, this is a major problem for many people who thought they don't believe in God and they're bothered by the question of why bad things happen to good people. But if they really didn't believe in God, then they wouldn't be bothered by this question because they would have come to a conclusion. Bad things happen, you know, like the bumper sticker. Something like the bumper sticker. That's it. It's a statement. It's not a question. Bad things happen. But if, on the other hand, somebody is bothered by the question, again, I'm repeating myself because it's so simple, then if they're bothered by it, it means that for them, they believe that God exists. Okay? That's the first point. In order for the question to exist, you need to believe there's a God, which is why in philosophy, they call this problem theodicy, which means judging God. In order for the question to be sustained, you need to assume certain things about God. One, that God is completely good. The second, that God is completely powerful. And the third, that God is completely knowledgeable. If you take away one of these three definitions about God, the problem will be immediately resolved or disappear. So therefore, what I stated was that the challenge is, for myself, is to try to understand how bad things can happen in this world, despite the fact that I believe that God is completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable. That was the challenge that we had. What we observed, and this we did at some length yesterday, we observed that there are a number of religions or philosophies who have to deal with the same question. And most of the time, the solution which is arrived at is simply, or maybe not so simply, changing one of the definitions. So therefore, if you say that God is not completely good, now you know why bad things happen. You say God is not completely powerful, you know why bad things happen. And if you say God is not completely knowledgeable, that's why bad things happen. Christianity, for example, chose to say that evil takes place because of the devil, which means that God is not completely powerful, which therefore means that if anybody here is a believing Christian, you have a major issue if you consider yourself a monotheist. Because if God is not completely powerful, you don't believe in one all-powerful God. You don't believe in one more powerful God. That's not monotheism, that's dualism. Which just shows you the extent that people have been bothered by this question. If Christianity has been willing to sacrifice monotheism in order to try to deal with the question, it just begins to show you how involved it is. So that I'll throw out as an introduction. Now, there are a couple of things that we have to consider, and then we can probably get to the main issue at hand. One issue is that this whole question is based upon our ability to be able to judge God. Because, again, that's theodicy, is judging God. That attempt to judge God may be something which man cannot do. Man's mind is limited. By definition, this, by the way, doesn't make a difference if you believe in God or not. By definition, if there is a God, God is something which is beyond human terms. So therefore, if there is a God, it's something which the human mind cannot completely understand. And therefore, the fact that things may happen in this world that we don't understand may not necessarily impinge on this issue of God being good, powerful, knowledgeable. It simply could be due to our lack of knowledge. Now, by the way, this isn't an answer. This is an observation. For some people, and this, to my mind, is somewhat of a fault of some of the religious community, is that they say, no, I can't judge God, and therefore everything is good, and everything is good, so therefore, you know, life is great. See, that's not really true. There are some people who think that in order to be religious, they just have to say everything was good. Now, it could be that everything is good, but there's a difference between philosophically everything being good and experientially. Experientially, you can be tortured, and if you're tortured, just to say, well, this is really good, this is really great, is it's worse than being shallow. And as you'll see as I continue, although we have to make that observation that this is correct. Just if you want me to try to illustrate this, if there would have been 300 years ago, a moral, ethical individual, a real moral, ethical individual, not like today. It's really bad, right? Today people define themselves as being good or moral by not doing evil things, right? That's a very minimalistic definition, a very sad definition. A good person, I would say, is somebody who tries to involve themselves in other people's lives, tries to help other people. So let's say there's a really good person, not this minimalistic, you know, good fences make good neighbors, bigger fences make better neighbors, and incredible fences make phenomenal neighbors who don't give a damn about anybody else because they're in their little world. And there is something very sad about that. But let's say somebody lived 300 years ago who is really good, decent, moral, ethical individual who walks into a room, and he sees bright lights in the room, and he sees somebody tied down to a table and a bunch of people with masks over their heads, and one of them takes a knife and is about to cut a, should I say the word? An incision into a person's, see, that makes it easier. An incision into the person's chest. And if he's a good, decent, moral person, he's going to try to save the life, because what does he see going on? Some sort of ritual, barbaric behavior. On the other hand, from the modern perspective, we see this, it's open-heart surgery trying to save somebody's life. So even a person who lived 300 years ago doesn't have the perspective to understand if he would have been thrust into the modern times, the modern world, to see something happening, would not understand it, then how dare us be able to stand here and to judge God and to say that we know better than God. Now, realize what I've just now done. On the one hand, to be able to judge God, I think, is something which is somewhat difficult because we don't have enough of a perspective. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that experientially, as things are happening, that we don't have a right to question. Those are two completely different issues. And I think that the right to question is extremely important. In fact, it says in the Bible, my thoughts are not your thoughts. Lo machshavosai machshavoseichem. That means that by definition, man will not be able to understand everything about God. By the way, one of the most positive aspects of the Messianic age, Nachmanides spells this out. He says that when the Messiah comes, it will not be enough if there's no more war, no more bloodshed, and so on. He says, if we're still tormented by the actions of the past, that's not enough. He says, the Messianic age will include within it a lecture by God, pointing his finger at every single aspect, every single event in history, explaining what his thinking was involved in this, till we can actually understand this. This is understood from a passage in the Talmud those of you that are keeping track, in Psachim on page 50b, towards the end of the page, end of the chapter, where it says that in this world, when something good happens, we say, Baruch HaTov HaMeitiv, blessed is God who's good and does good. When something bad happens, we say, Baruch Dain HaEmes, blessed is God who's a true judge, which means we accept that he's a true judge, but we just don't understand the judgment. Because if we understood the judgment, we would say, blessed is God who's good. But the Talmud continues to say that in the future world, we'll be able to say on everything, blessed is Baruch HaTov HaMeitiv, blessed is God who's good and does good. Now, right now, see, I'm aware of the absurdity of what I'm saying, so you don't have to point it out to me. I'm aware that in the aftermath of the Holocaust, for anyone to say, you know, we'll just be able to point our fingers at that and say, well, you know, thank you, God, that was great, is absolutely absurd. So therefore, this ability to be able to say that God will at some point be able to explain this to us, and that will make sense, so I'm saying that's absolutely unbelievable, but that's part of the Messianic belief, that not just will there be a redemption on a physical sense, there will also be redemption on a psychological sense, on an emotional sense. And in fact, if you really begin to think about it, you'll realize that emotional or psychological redemption is far more important than physical redemption. For a person who's physically free, but he's tormented by all sorts of things that haunt him, that person's not really free. While conversely, if a person is being tormented, but psychologically he's able to feel himself as free, that person is completely free. The Messianic age needs to have both components to it. So can I understand how God will be able to give this lecture? No, not at all. I'm saying that's what the Talmud insists. That's what true redemption is. Just simply having no more war, no more bloodshed, and so on is very good, very attractive. But that's not enough. So first, or I don't know what I'm up to. The last point I said is that we don't always know. We can't always know what God is thinking, but hopefully one day God will share this with us. Other point that somebody made yesterday in passing, that sometimes when we consider something to be bad, it's not necessarily bad. Not all things from our limited human perspective are bad. Again, let me try to give an analogy to this. Okay, let's say I have a 2-year-old child. I think I came up with this when I had a 2-year-old child, which I don't right now. But hopefully I will soon. That makes sense? I have 4 boys that are all types of ages, and I have a little baby girl. Now, I'm not sure if the girl's going to act the same way as the boy. I don't know. Nature, nurture, she's in trouble either way. Now, let's say you have a 2-year-old who finds a paper clip, right? And has a paper clip in his or her hand. And you're a good parent. What do? The other side of the room. Raymond, be careful now. What do you do? Other side of the room, what do you do? Scream at them, hit them, shoot them. Like, what do you do? Let's say they start walking towards an outlet. And to make it more exciting, there's a puddle on the floor next to the outlet. What do you do? A good parent. What would you do?
You calmly go over them.
They're running to the outlet. They smile at you. And they run.
Hold them nicely. Don't scream. Otherwise, we'll just go. I mean, pick them up. You show
them. No. But by the way, this isn't so simple. Yeah, you run for the circuit breaker. Great. You run downstairs. 3 flights. Okay. Anyway. You're right. Go ahead. What do you do?
You pick them. You give them some other good experience. Pick them up.
You're the other side of the room.
On the other side of the room.
Yeah.
Oh, at the other side.
Yeah, the other side of the room.
Okay,
listen. Yeah, see, that's good. Offer them a cookie, offer them chocolate. Try to divert their attention. But let's be honest, most parents in that situation are going to go crazy. And if they scream at the child, okay, let's say you try it first. You say, you know, come over here, check out this new Ninja Turtle or whatever, this new, you know, I got a nuclear bomb here. You want to come play with it? See, my sons, that would have worked. So you try to get their attention, but they ignore you, and they start, you know, running over to that outlet, and they have this thing in their hands. So if you come flying across the room and smack their hand and get the thing out of hand, the child will start to cry and to scream and to say, why do bad things happen to good people? Or am I wrong about that? No, but it's interesting, because for the child, playing with the paper clip is not something which is really that bad. It's not one of these things that they've been raised about. I don't know any of you have ever had children like this, that you have to wake up in the morning and say, now what bizarre thing can this child do today? Again, I have at least one like this. I mean, you don't figure you have to tell them, don't bring in the hose from the backyard and water the carpet because nothing will grow. I laughed about it when I came home from work. So yeah, that's pretty funny. Great, look at this. All these people are laughing at my pain. Isn't this great? it's great. Anyway, the child will not necessarily be able to articulate the words, but that's the experience the child is going through. I didn't do something which was so bad. I didn't pull my brother's hair. I didn't set the house on fire. I was playing with a paperclip. What was so bad about this? So therefore, the child may not be able to articulate but say, why do bad things happen to good people? But again, is there a larger gulf between the knowledge of a two-year-old and an adult or the knowledge between an adult and God? So I'm saying, I'm just illustrating the same point again, that we cannot necessarily understand things that happen, but then again, experientially, when something happens to us, it is quite difficult. So all that is considered. Raymond?
Is it possible that you just say we don't understand why everything happens? Yeah, it's a known fact that the most human beings only use 1% of their brain. Their thoughts are more than their brain. No. I mean that's a known fact.
I want to know who figured that. I want to know who figured that out. I have one question. Was this study done in England? among the royal family.
You'll be able to understand a lot more than what you can do if you only use 1% of your brain.
I agree. One second. And therefore?
Therefore, we get to that period.
One second. And if you use 100% of your brain, do you then beat God in a game of chess?
No. What I'm saying is, we're able to understand more of why God does what he does. He and the Vegas have turned, obviously. But would you not agree with that?
I agree with that. It's just not relevant. No. See, I agree with you. I wish you would have been here yesterday. Where were you? No, see, I agree with you that if we use our minds more, we would understand more, but that's not going to help us with the basic problem. The basic problem is that God knows more than us. Okay? God sort of has this issue of being transcendental, outside of time. I mean, there's a lot more to say about this. Sir?
You're saying about the child with the paperclip, but to us and to the adult, the child might be thinking, why do bad things happen to good people? But for that person, or say for that child's lack of knowledge, you can go to the other extreme, and someone who I know was religious, went to synagogue, came back from synagogue, went to visit his grandma, and on the way back home, he got knocked over.
Right.
Now that's to the other extreme, where he's got the knowledge of being able to cross the road perfectly fine, and that just on foot from that day, he got knocked over, and that's more sort of why the bad things happen to good people.
So let me go on a little bit. But again, my point was that we don't understand as much as God. We don't see the same picture. This doesn't answer the question, but it just helps set up the parameters a little bit better. Next issue. How bad is bad? I'm sorry for asking such silly things. How bad does something have to be considered bad? On a scale of 1 to 10. I mean, no. How bad is something? Say, well, that was bad. I mean, what sort of thing would cause you to ask the question, why do bad things happen to good people? How bad does something have to be?
Somebody's persecuted
us. So that means you've had a bad day. What? Good.
You shouldn't repeat the pain. If you get some big problem, okay, you can say, okay, it's by chance, but somebody that is a good person has many, many, many problems.
Again, please define bad. Bad is?
Yeah.
Bad is relative. You know my mother-in-law. Okay, I'm kidding. Yeah?
Something terrible that can't be changed. It's like you've gone through something like death or something like that.
Irreversible, cosmic, yeah. Permanent.
Yeah, something terrible.
That's sad. Yeah.
There are many things that are objectively that the body would view as bad, And then on a subjective level, it would depend on you putting yourself in that person's circumstances. We could all look at a particular event, like an earthquake, and say, well, that is just bad. But then on a small scale, if a person, we didn't really understand a person's particular life and what they've gone through, we'd have to know that to be able to perceive whether it's bad or not.
Okay, I think that's good. Generally, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's psychological suffering, so it's very hard to say. I mean, for a little kid, losing their dog can be a much worse experience than an adult losing his or her father, because
it's so traumatic. Okay, correct. Let me make an observation. If you want to, go ahead.
Yeah, it seems that what's bad and what's good, it only depends on the scope in which you're living at.
See, it's interesting. Most times, most people you'll ask, what is bad? They'll go back to the sort of definition like you gave. Bad is something irreversible. Bad is death. Bad is earthquakes. Bad is AIDS. Bad is cancer. Something which we just don't seem to be able to deal with. But I want you to think about something, at first purely philosophically, and then you'll understand what I'm saying. If my my philosophical definition of bad, or let me reframe the question, how bad does something have to be to me to say, where was God? Because let's bring this back into the God scenario. If indeed God is completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable, how bad should something be for me to say, so where were you, God? What happened? How bad? Think. When we say that God is completely good, how good are we talking about? 100%. Completely powerful? How powerful? 100%. Completely knowledgeable? 100%. So how bad should something have to be?
99%.
How bad should something have to be for God? What happened? 100% bad? How bad? Which one? Which one is it?
100% bad.
Only a slight percentage.
The slightest thing should be. You got it? The slightest thing should be causing me to say, well, God, where were you? Anybody here ever stub your toe? I did it on Friday. When you stub your toe, what's the first thing you say? No. What's the first thing you say after that?
I want to think where you are.
After that, do you say, why do bad things happen to good people?
No.
But that's very interesting, because if I really believe that God is 100% good, 100% powerful, 100% knowledgeable, I shouldn't just stub my toe. God has the ability. God saw what was going on. God knew what was going on. God is good. Why couldn't he move that table out of the way?
See, I don't fully get the 100% knowledgeable part, the good and the all-powerful.
Yeah.
I hear that, but the whole, a large premise of what we're saying is that God is 100% knowledgeable.
Yes.
And that we can't see that.
Right.
So therefore,
you can't see he's good or powerful either.
No, well, I'm saying we can't see those either.
Yeah, this is my premise. I'm saying without these three, let's realize again what I did. Without this premise that God is good, powerful, knowledgeable, there's no question. The question disappears. So the question, therefore, is, because I believe that God is good, powerful, and knowledgeable, so that therefore I'm asking...
That's the answer, too, in a sense.
Maybe or maybe not, but I'm saying, how bad should something be for me to say, where is God? But it's interesting none of us do that. People begin to say, where was God, when something really catastrophic takes place. When you stub your toe, this doesn't happen. The Talmud actually says that if you put your hand in your pocket and you're looking for three coins, and you pull out only two coins, you have to go through all the pain and the suffering of looking for a third coin. The Talmud says, this should be cause for introspection. A person should say to God, you know, what happened? What went on in my life? Now, but this is something which is an amazing point. I mean, I, again, Jews are neurotic enough as it is. This doesn't mean that every step you take and the rest of every breath you take, that you have to say, God, what happened? Why does my foot hurt? Why does this hurt? Oy, and this. Maybe some Jews do this. But realize then that if I really assume these things about God, I should be asking any time the world is imperfect. So that's really the issue. Yes. Imperfection should cause me to ask what happened. For example, starvation in Africa. Is that something bad? Why are so many people starving? Because of God, right? Why? Because of governments, because of politics, because of capitalism. I'm sorry. Supply, demand, right? Because of other sorts of conflicts, a bunch of things converging on one another. But we all know, I think we all know, that there's enough food right now for every single person in this world to have three meals a day. It doesn't happen. Many people die. And by the way, it's very easy to blame God for that. I just have to remind some of us that God created a Garden of Eden. God created a perfect world. Man has succeeded in turning this world into a hell on earth. That's through our decisions. That's through our actions. But the world that God created was a perfect world. But let's go back a little bit. Starvation is something terrible. When starvation happens, then it's too big for us to be able to deal with. It's too immense. So therefore, when anything is too big, see, this is the catch-22. When something really bad happens, we say we can't do anything about it. When something really small happens, we ignore it. So therefore, we end up going through most of our lives without ever dealing with this issue on a much more sophisticated level of why bad things or how to deal with when bad things happen. So therefore, the Jewish question, I think, would be a little bit different. It shouldn't be starvation in Africa, so where is God, why is bad things happening? It should be, you know, why did my neighbor go without a meal? Why is my neighbor may have lost a job, why is my neighbor going without a meal, and what can I do about it? Judaism, ultimately, is an action-oriented religion. Judaism will say that if this person is going without a meal and I can do something about it, I should be doing something about it. Throughout the Middle Ages, I don't know to what extent you know this, throughout the Middle Ages, there was no such thing as a phenomenon of homeless people in the Jewish communities. If someone were homeless, they moved into the synagogue. That's all. You know that there's a custom that, those of you from the diaspora may recognize this, that after the prayers on the Sabbath in the synagogue, they say Kiddush in the shul. Do you know why? For all the homeless people. That was the custom. There was no such thing as anybody living on the street. The community took responsibility. The community had a tax system to make sure that every single person would get at least their three meals a day. So therefore, if I see imperfection in the world, that there's something bad going on. If there's something bad going on, then I have to become involved in it. So, therefore, the first response that we have to realize is that when we ask this question, why do bad things happen to good people, I'm not just talking about catastrophes. I'll get to some of those as well. But I'm talking about even degrees of imperfection is something which we should be sensitive to. The problem is that we've become so desensitized. You live in a society that there's so many homeless people. You live in a society where there's so much pain and suffering. After a while, it becomes overwhelming and we stop paying attention to it. Judaism is saying that if I realize that God is completely good, powerful, and knowledgeable, nothing bad should ever happen. If nothing bad should ever happen, then why is it happening? If it's happening, so what can I do to respond to it? If I see imperfection, I have to respond. That is basic Jewish doctrine. Sir?
It seems to me that you know, people distinguish between something that they can sort of see as their own fault. So when you stop your tape, you don't blame God because you see it was your own fault for not paying enough attention. Whereas when an earthquake happens, there's nothing you could have done about that at all, and therefore that is that.
Give me another 2 minutes. Let me continue. There's actually a logic to the sequence of things I'm saying. I know this comes as a surprise sometimes, but especially to me. But there is a sequence. Go back to the initial question. Why do bad things happen to good people? What is the most difficult word in that sentence?
Why?
Good. You see, if you think about it, if we talked about it long enough, we can decide what is bad, what is good, probably even what are people. But the question why is something quite difficult. But somebody explain to me why is why difficult. Go ahead.
Whatever the answer is, we can't understand.
That why is perhaps more philosophical than the others. Who here has studied science to some extent? Okay, I'll pick on you. Why does water freeze at 32 degrees Fahrenheit?
You can explain it, but it just does.
It's like
you're saying why perpetuates another life.
Yeah, because you can tell me this whole thing about the molecules slowly, but you realize, of course, that I'm going to say afterwards
why?
Yeah, and then at the end you're going to end up saying. Because, by the way, if... No, you will. Because, see, science can ask a couple different questions. Science can ask what happens, and science can ask how can I gain from what has happened. The question why is a philosophical question which science cannot deal with. I'm sorry if anybody has great faith in science, but it can't answer why. And it's fascinating because we automatically hear the question why and answer the question what. We just switch it around. Instead of saying, why does this happen, what happens? And we explain the cause and the effect on the causative level, but not on the philosophical level. So a scientist would feel very, very comfortable. Again, leading scientists, if I wouldn't have given you this introduction, who said, why does water freeze? You'd say, because the molecules slow down. But then you realize that somebody can say, yeah, but why does the molecules slow down? And eventually you get to the point of saying, well, that's a rule of nature. Should I tell you why the Holocaust happened? Anyone know why the Holocaust happened? What? No, because the Jews were the were the traditional scapegoats in Germany, and because of the economic situation, the Germans looked for a scapegoat, and therefore they picked the Jews. Anybody happy? Because I told you, I told you what happened. That doesn't satisfy anybody, because I did not deal with the philosophical issue. I dealt with the technical issue of what happened. I dealt with the causative issue, cause and effect. Scapegoat, kill them, that's it. No, but you want to know why. Ultimately, who can answer why? This is a little difficult. Ultimately, who can answer the question of why? God. Which means, and I want to be very careful about this, because I'm probably insulting a lot of my colleagues now. I don't believe that anybody can ever tell you why something happens, unless they are God or have the knowledge of God. And if somebody comes and tells you, well, this is why the Holocaust happened, then I would just say, that's fascinating. So when exactly did you have your revelation? Or do you have a day job, you know? However, if a person says, this is how I understand what has happened, that's completely different. Why? Because then they've shifted it from the objective to the subjective. Correct? If a person says subjectively, this is how I've come to deal with it, this is how I've come to understand it, that's something very different. Which means, let's begin by realizing that this question, the basic question, why do bad things happen to good people, presumes that I can understand why bad things are happening, which means that the theologian is blessed with all sorts of information. By the way, the Talmud at times tells us this is why certain things happen. So in those situations, the Talmud must have some sort of a tradition. We're told the Second Temple was destroyed because people hated one another, so they must have had some sort of tradition about this. Maybe I'll talk more about this on Tisha B'Av, not today. The Holocaust, maybe I may talk about that more tomorrow. So let's leave that aside also. And let's focus now on the broader question of how to deal with this question of why bad things happen to good people. I think, however, that there may be a second way of dealing with the why. In order to do this, let me, again, give some sort of an illustration. Does anybody here know what Lashon Hara is? What is it? Speaking ill of the gossiping. In Judaism, this is a good thing, correct? No, not such a good thing. In fact, if you've even heard people say that it was hatred, groundless hatred, that destroyed the temple, the Chafetz Chaim says that the manifestation of hatred is speaking ill about one another. That's the matter. Meaning, it's one thing that I feel bad about somebody else, but if I start to speak about them, that is how the hatred begins to come out and to manifest itself. Okay, Lashon Hara. Let's say I see you 2 minutes before class, and I say, I got to tell you something about such and such a person. And what do you say? Go ahead. No. What do you say? You say, that's Lashon Hara. I don't want to hear that. Right? I say, no, but it's really good. So as we're going back and forth, and he's saying, listen, it's really not right. As we're talking, I'm standing by the door. You open the door hits me in my mouth. My mouth starts to bleed. So any of you watching this, why is my mouth bleeding? Because the door hit it, right? So therefore, the question of what happened would be that the door hit it. Now, why did I deserve to have the door hit me? I'll be a little more careful now. Why did I deserve to have it? Anybody tempted with the answer?
Because you're speaking with someone.
Would you say that? Would you? And because he was speaking. How many people would be tempted to say it? Tempted. You don't have to admit it. You can't say it. Listen, it's pretty good. Karma, right? What?
Depends what you would say.
How many of you would say it? Just the Americans, right? Where are you from? Where are you from?
Me?
Yeah.
Israel.
Israelis for sure. Okay.
If you believe that you were about to speak Lashon Hara and that could have been a very direct thing, I'll say it.
You'll say it. So it's interesting. The Talmud says something bad happens, what should I do? Cause for introspection. Start thinking to myself, I'm a good person, why do I deserve this to happen to me? And I start thinking, and then I get it. Why did this thing happen to me? Because this morning, after I parked my car and I started walking up to the old city, there was this old poor woman collecting charity, and I didn't give her any money. And I realized the reason that the door hit me because I didn't give charity. Am I right or am I wrong? Let's go back a second. Let's say you want to say the door hit me because I spoke Lashon Hara. Are you right about that or are you wrong about that? You don't know. So why are you saying it if you don't know it? Okay, I'll stop. You basically, what? You would say it anyway. So are you right or you're wrong?
I think you can't rationalize.
So then why are you saying it then? If
because something
it felt good.
And I would feel at that moment that me saying something bad, in some way or another, just like I don't understand a lot of things, is a reflection of what happened to me.
So you feel good when rabbis get up and point accusative fingers at people and say, you're a sinner and that's why this and this happened to you?
That's a bad method, but the overall concept of doing bad and getting bad in return, I agree with.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Again, we don't have enough perspective to know why that door hit me. We don't know. You could say Lashon Hara, and you know what? My gut reaction is that you're right. It seems like so closely correlated that it seems that it's connected. On the other hand, I don't know. Now, this is the important point. Let's say I decide it's because of my lack of giving tzedakah, my lack of giving charity. Charity, by the way, is not the English translation of tzedakah. The word tzedakah comes from the root of tzedek. Tzedek means righteousness. Tzedek means, in a sense, judgment. The Zohar goes far as to say that tzedakah, tzedek hey, is tzedek Hashem, that you become partners with God, that there is this person who's disenfranchised and you help the disenfranchised individual, therefore you become partners with God in order to make sure that there's justice in this world. Anybody know what the highest level of charity is? Okay, you know what the lowest level of charity is? What's the highest level?
Giving honestly.
Higher than that? Giving a job. Right. Lowest level of charity, there's at least 8 different levels of charity. But this is important. Let's say, from that moment on, the door strikes me, I say, look at that. I have not been taking my charity all that seriously, and now God came to give me a message. From this day onward, I will dedicate myself to giving charity, and I dedicate myself towards it. The lowest level of charity is when you look somebody in the eye, they ask you for money, and they say, I'm starving, give me money. And you say, you bum, why don't you get yourself a job, you give them some money. Okay? The Rambam says, that's almost better if you didn't do it. Better than that is giving somebody after they've asked but not saying anything derogatory. Better than that is to give before they asked for it. Say, hey, you look like you can use a cup of coffee, some food, whatever. Give them something before they've asked for it. Better than that is giving and they don't know where it came from. Better than that is giving and you don't know where it's going to and they don't know where it came from. By the way, any of you going back to different communities, that's a wonderful job to take, to be a conduit for charity to be given to people. To go over to, there are a lot of people out there would like to give charity and help other people out, but they're just afraid that they're going to get ripped off by somebody. And there are a lot of people that need it, but they're a little embarrassed to ask. To take a sort of a position, what's called tradition is a gabbai tzedakah, to go around to people that have money, go around to people that don't have money, and you serve as this intermediary conduit for the tzedakah to flow is simply a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful job to have, and in many communities in Israel there are people that have that type of a position. Better than that is giving somebody a job. Because then what you're saying to the person is, we need you, society needs you. And if you really think about it, the core of tzedakah, the essence of tzedakah, is that every single person has an inalienable right to their dignity. And the more dignity that remains, the higher level of tzedakah. So therefore, the lowest level where you give the guy and you curse him out, there's no dignity which is retained in that case. It may even be better if you didn't do it. Then again, if the guy's starving, I can't say it's better if you didn't do it because you saved the guy's life, but you destroyed his dignity. But if you're able to say to somebody that we really need you, society really needs you, and take a job and do something because I can really use your help, that's the most wonderful level. So from that moment on, I dedicate myself towards tzedakah, and I arrange things for people, and I give loans and free loans and jobs and so on. And now, I'm 38 years old. If I spend the rest of my life involved in the giving of charity, what would you say was the watershed moment in my life which changed me from being somebody who was extremely spiritually challenged and dysfunctional to becoming somebody who was involved in other people and helping some other people? What was it? The moment the door hit me. So why did the door hit me? See, what I'm suggesting now is that ultimately in God's mind, I may never know why the door hit me. But I have the ability of determining why that door hit me. Which means that my response to bad things that take place could determine why that happened. Perhaps, as I said earlier, perhaps on a subjective level, but that itself is significant. Maimonides says that there's 3 basic ways that people can respond to bad things that happen. One way is for a person, let's think about it. The door hits me, right? You open the door hit me. What would happen if I would turn around, punch him in the head, and say, be more careful next time? Would that be a good response to my pain and suffering? So one way is simply to pass on your pain to somebody else. I mean, very often, people are victims of abuse, they end up passing the abuse on to another generation. Another response is for somebody to pull in and say, well, this was something which was really difficult. What can I learn from this? And maybe even how can I share or how can I help others with this? That's a wonderful response. What's the third response? No response. And what is no, and this is a little difficult. What is no response? Is that good, bad, or neither?
Bad because it's building up inside
you. More than that. More than that. Maimonides says that not to respond to pain is cruel. He uses the word cruelty. Achzari. He says it's cruel. Why? Because then you would have created meaningless pain in the world. Think a second. If God is completely good, completely powerful, completely knowledgeable, something bad happens. Why did that bad thing happen? Because God allowed that bad thing to happen. Either by commission, by omission. I'm not going to get involved in that question. One way or the other, God allowed this thing to happen. So therefore, there's some sort of message involved in this. There's something that I can learn from this. If I learn the proper lesson, I am able to elevate myself. Again, I have the freedom of choice, and I could become cruel and evil because of this, and I could perpetuate my suffering and pain onto other people. But Imani says there's a third response. The third response is no response. No response he also deems as being cruel, because then he says that you turn the pain into something meaningless, which therefore means, in Maimonides' perspective, God gives no meaningless pain in this world. God gives pain. Whether the pain will be meaningful or meaningless is completely up to us and depending on how we respond to it. On a psychological level, what he's saying is completely true. The sooner that a person is able to try to find some sort of meaning to their pain, the sooner that their pain is no longer as difficult as it was prior to that. I mean, for example, if you'll ask any woman who's gone through natural childbirth, you'll ask them afterwards, was it painful? What will they say? No. Absolutely. Absolutely. But what natural childbirth does, what Lamaze does, is it teaches techniques in order to be able to deal with the pain, to focus the pain. Well, the word which is common today is to reframe it. To say that every single act of pain which is taking place right now is part of the process of a baby coming into the world. Someone will have a little picture of a baby in front of them, focusing on a baby. Did it hurt? Hell, it hurt. Will people come out of it saying that was the most invigorating thing I've ever done in my life? Painful, yes. Hell, it was painful. It was more painful than anything I've ever gone through. Would I do it again? Yeah. Does that make sense? Because they were able to focus the pain, and they connected the pain with something very positive, which they saw resulted from the pain. The more that we would have an ability of seeing our pain within the context of something positive coming out with it, the sooner we can do that, the sooner we're able to deal with the pain. There's a couple of other issues. Maybe I'll go at least 2 or 3 minutes over. I could have, you know, we could have started from the beginning and saying, why create a world with pain at all? Why do we need pain? Meaning, God could have made a world without any pain whatsoever. What? Well, yeah, it would have been extremely boring, that's true, yeah.
It's a stimulus for change.
Yeah, pain is something, even the possibility, by the way, the possibility of pain is a stimulus. That's, yeah?
You also have no achievement. If you don't see any pain, then you don't necessarily see any good either. Therefore, you've got nothing to achieve.
In effect, what you're saying is that if there would be no bad, there would be no good either.
Yeah.
I think this is...
You wouldn't be able to differentiate.
All that there would be nothingness. In a sense, this is part of the price that we pay for creation. The price that we pay is to have a world where there is good and where there is bad, obviously as much as possible trying to reject the bad in front of us, but we know that there is a possibility. If God creates the world, then, you know, even if I'll give you an absurdity, let's say the worst thing that ever happened in the world was the common cold. Would that still be bad? Sure, it would. It would be tragic. People would treat it as if it were tragedy. It means if you want to get rid of evil or pain or bad or suffering, you'd have to get rid of every single thing, and all that you'd have left was good. And by the way, even if you had degrees of good, something which was less good than the other thing itself would then be deemed as being bad. So therefore, in effect, what you would have is no life whatsoever. In order for there to be life, there needs to be different sorts of varieties of experience, and therefore these varieties will be interpreted some as better than others, which means the price of being created is having this possibility of pain. Yeah.
Couldn't God have created us with the ongoing capacity to feel even more good, even though there is no evil? If God's all powerful, we could have done that too.
Correct. Obviously, he chose that this way is better. And by the way, part of the whole concept of the world to come
is earning a place in that type of an environment, which means that is the world that God created. You're saying, why didn't God? He did create that world. But through our choices, we decided to make a different type of world, which was full of pain and suffering. Garden of Eden didn't have it. That's what we created. And that's where we end up. But it's very different earning that type of existence versus being placed in it. Let's go one step further now. In order for life to be meaningful, there needs to be freedom of choice. Is that clear? But let me turn this around a little bit. Maybe the only people that should ever suffer pain are people that are sinners. Do you like that? Only people that speak Lashon Hara should be hit with the door. Every time you speak Lashon Hara, a door should come flying away, smack you in the mouth. If that would happen, does anybody see a problem?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, because you would always be,
you'd be programmed. Behavior modification.
Yeah.
Right, you'd be behavior modification. No one would speak Lashon Hara anymore unless you put like a football helmet on. See, I got to tell you something, 1 second. But it would become an absurdity because if, think about this very carefully now, if quote-unquote punishment and pain or suffering and pain were closely correlated, that would impinge on people's freedom of choice. Because then it's clearly connected one with the other. Just 1 second. And if this is true on the micro level, this is also true on the macro level. Let's go back one more step. If every single time somebody spoke Lashon Hara, a door came and hit them, when people speak Lashon Hara? No. If every single time somebody slept with their neighbor's spouse, they would drop dead of a heart attack, how many people would sleep with their neighbor's spouse? Only suicidal people, right? Life is too tough, I'm going to go, you leave a note, and then, okay. It's better than a bullet, right? Right. Stop. Now. on the other hand, think about the macro for a second. Voltaire once asked what he decided was a wonderful question. There was a terrible earthquake in Lisbon, and he said, am I expected to believe that only the 40,000 guilty people died in the earthquake? Do you hear what he's saying? That if you can show that each person was guilty, then he can accept that God did it. And I'm saying quite the opposite. If I could show that only the guilty people died, that would take away freedom of choice. That when God deals with people, it has to be done in a way that I cannot easily be able to identify, because it also takes away freedom of choice. Without freedom of choice, life has no meaning. God created us in this world, gave us life, gave us freedom of choice. There is a capacity for bad things to happen, and things cannot be so closely correlated, because that would impinge on our ability to have free choice. I guess I have to move towards a conclusion, right? Okay. I once saw something in a very obscure source in Maimonides, which I'll end with. I want you to think a second before I say it. On our scale of values, would we prefer to have spiritual pleasure or physical pleasure? Which one is really better? Intense physical pleasure or intense spiritual pleasure? It's not an easy question, and everyone has to ask themselves. Maimonides says, from the Jewish worldview, spiritual pleasure is greater. That's his statement. And then he says the following. If on your scale of values, spiritual pleasure is greater than physical pleasure, it follows then that physical pain is nowhere nearly as unfortunate as spiritual deprivation or ignorance. What Maimonides is saying is that if I realize that spiritual pleasure is greater than the physical pleasure, then I'll have to realize the converse is also true. That physical pain is not as bad as not being spiritually sensitive. Which means, what's the really bad thing in my life that I described earlier? The door hitting me in the mouth, or being insensitive to other people in terms of charity? Which was really the bad thing? Maimonides would insist that a spiritually sensitive individual would realize that being nonchalant towards other people's pain and suffering is itself the bad thing. So let's conclude. In order to ask this question, why do bad things happen to good people? It means that you believe in God. In order for the question to be sustained, you have to assume that God is good, powerful, and knowledgeable. Change any of the three, you've solved the problem immediately. How bad does something have to be? The slightest thing, imperfection, is already something which is bad. Can we understand everything that God does? No, not at all. This question, why bad things happen to good people, is an important question. Can we necessarily answer that question? Well, yes or no. We cannot answer it objectively. We cannot peek into God's mind and know what God had in mind. But what we choose to respond itself becomes the response for it, which means that we have an incredible amount of ability of dealing with our pain. Incidentally, if we could be sensitive to other people's pain and be able to grow from other people's pain, We would therefore not necessitate pain in our lives. Face it. The world has more than enough pain right now that nobody has to go through any pain at this point. The problem is that too many people have built those big fences around their houses, not feeling other people's pain. If God wants us to grow spiritually, then God is going to put pain in this world. Ultimately, having pain in the world is part of creation. We have freedom of choice. If we're too closely correlated, we lose that freedom of choice. Ultimately, in conclusion, we saw that if we realize that spiritual growth is more important than physical growth, then we realize that the physical pain was not as bad as the spiritual deprivation or ignorance, and therefore what it behooves us is to look at other people's pain, to feel our pain, to be able to ask why these things are happening, and most importantly, to get a response to it and be able to grow spiritually from it. Okay, sorry for going over time. Thank you.